Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome all, and thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney-based independent freelance journalist, author, and blogger from Australia. His best-selling book on the Israel-Palestinian conflict, My Israel Question, was released by Melbourne University Publishing in 2006. A new updated edition was released in 2007, and it was reprinted again in 2008. Anthony Lowenstein was a contributor to the 2008 Verso Books release, A Time to Speak Out, on Israel, Zionism, and Jewish Identity. His second book, The Blogging Revolution on the Internet in Repressive Regimes, was released in 2008 by Melbourne University Publishing. He writes regularly for online magazines New Matilda and Crikey in Australia, and is a board member of Macquarie University Centre for Middle East and Northern African Studies in Sydney. He's also an honorary associate at the university's Department of Politics and International Relations, and was co-founder of an advocacy group, Independent Australian Jewish Voices. Anthony appears regularly around the world on TV and radio, including Democracy Now!, and has spoken at Harvard and other universities discussing current affairs, politics, and media. Anthony Lowenstein, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I think we need to ground this interview, which will be discussing contentious issues, I guess, in talking a little bit about your background, Anthony, and I think your grandparents, were they involved in the Holocaust? What is your personal story?
I'm 34, and I was born in Melbourne in 1974. And my parents are both born in Melbourne during the Second World War. So they're Australian-born. My grandparents, though, on both sides, were born in Europe, one in Austria and one side in Dresden in Germany. Thankfully, they were able to get out just before the war, so they left in 1939 and came to Australia. And like most Jews in Europe, if you could get out, you pretty much went where you could go. So some went to the UK, some went to the US, some went to Canada, some came to Australia. The vast majority, sadly, of course, could not get out, and like so many Jews, realized too late that Hitler was serious when he wanted to try and extinguish the whole Jewish race in Europe, and they were killed in the Holocaust in Auschwitz and other places like that. But thankfully, my grandparents on both sides came out to Australia, and they've all passed away now, sadly, but I remember them telling me years ago when they were alive that there was always a situation that people who came to Australia then, so early 40s, late 30s, found Australia then a very, very kind of culturally backward place. And many of them used to say to me that Australia only really became interesting, in their view, kind of in the 50s and 60s when there was a massive wave of migration from all over the world.
Yes. So what attitudes did you grow up with, Anthony, towards Israel and the homeland? What did your parents think? What did they inculcate into you? How have you developed your philosophies at the age of 34?
Israel, in some ways, when I was growing up, and my family and parents were liberal Jews, liberal in the American sense of the word, so quite progressive, I guess you would say. But what that meant was that Israel was never rammed down my throat, but at the same time it was simply expected that I would support it. So I remember quite distinctly when I was a young guy in my teens or even before that, that if we were trying to have a discussion at, say, the family table, both at my, I'm an only child, so with my parents or with my extended family about Israel, and there was some situation back then, there was some bombing in Palestine or Arafat had done something or whatever it may be, I remember sometimes I was like wanted to sort of cause a bit of trouble, and if I was would ask a question about maybe the wiseness of certain policies, of Israeli policies, I was shouted down or that was inappropriate to be said. So in other words, I use that as just as an example that there was seeming little space for actual debate about this issue. In other words, there was nothing to debate. Israel was the homeland. Mm-hmm. Israel was a safe haven, and the argument always was, God forbid something happens again, like the Holocaust, we as Jews would have a place to go. Now, when I was probably 7 or 8 or 10, that was pretty convincing as an argument. I didn't really have the tools to challenge that idea. But I think as I got older, in my teens, and I was growing up at that stage in Melbourne, and I went to an Anglican school, which and there were very few Jews there, I have to say, the sense about Israel was very much, I felt increasingly uncomfortable with what I saw with my Jewish friends at the time, who most of whom had not been to Israel at that stage, but somehow felt the need to always defend it unquestioningly. So something would happen, and let's say, of course, this is before the internet, and as much as I grew up before the internet as well, but when one thinks about world events and world affairs, the lack of information about events before the internet strikes me now as incredibly startling. So you only really would know what the major papers would say, or the local TV, or the radio. That was pretty much your only source of information. And most of the media then, and I would argue generally still now, is pretty pro-Israel. I'd say in much of the West, including the US and certainly in Australia. There are pockets of dissent here and there. But so if someone came out as a Jew, as I would sometimes do in my teens, or even when I was a bit older, when I got to university, to question some of those established norms or some of those narratives about Israel. I mean, I'll give you a quick example. I went to Sunday school, which is quite a typical thing that Jewish kids go to train for their bar bat mitzvah.
You mean a Jewish Sunday school?
Indeed, indeed, on a Sunday. Mm. And most of the kids there, they were pretty liberal like I was, or their families were liberal, relatively liberal. But I remember the history that I was taught about Israel was exactly the same as the history that I was taught at school about Australia, and that was that people came to an empty land. In Australia's case, it was the English. In Israel's case, it was Jews from Europe. Nobody was there, and they built a land essentially out of nothing. The Palestinians or Arabs who were there were kind of simply cast aside, and anyone who resisted was essentially a terrorist. And the narrative I was told about Australia was remarkably similar. There were some blacks here, but, you know, they kind of, you know, we just kind of got past them and kind of moved on. Now, again, I would say that that narrative in Australia, although some people still believe that, it still was pretty strong, I would argue, 20 years ago when I was at school. And in Sunday school, Jewish Sunday school without Israel, there are incredible similarities, although differences as well, between Israel's birth and Australia's birth. And I would argue that, in fact, although Australia has profound issues with its indigenous population, and those issues are far from reconciled, Israel, I would argue, has not even started that discussion, really. And Australia, with all its faults, and I criticise Australia regularly, has at least begun the conversation. Israel has not even begun.
So then you went to university. What happened to you there, Anthony?
I think in some ways, in probably typical fashion, I started doing some more reading. I think I was pretty sheltered, to be honest, Helen, when I was growing up. And again, I'd say it comes back down to the fact that before the age of the internet, the ability, apart from reading books, of course, but apart from getting information easily, wasn't that easy. It actually took effort, for example, to find an Israeli newspaper in English. Now you go online and you can find them, you know, within 2 seconds. But then it was very, very difficult. And most people didn't even bother. So I started reading people like Edward Said, the famous now past Palestinian thinker and academic.
Where he was at New York University, where was he?
He was at Columbia. And he, of course, faced over his life profound struggles, not least being firebombed at his office when he was there. And the reality is that to have a articulate Palestinian person, such as he was, and who got, obviously his most famous work was Orientalism, which came out in the late 70s, which is still a wonderful text that everyone should read, that very much was a threat to the narrative of Israel, the narrative very much of the Leon Uris Exodus myth that I was sold at Sunday school as well, as I said before, i.e. Jews came to Palestine, built a land out of nothing, and here we are today, this wonderfully successful country with some terrorists who don't like us that much for some unknown reason. So university came along for me, and I started reading very widely, Jewish and non-Jewish writers. And in the 1980s, this is really before I was at university, but there were a group of Israeli historians called the New Historians who essentially challenged the myths of Israel's birth. People like Benny Morris and Ilan Pape, people who are now still now very well known, some of whom live in Israel, some of whom have moved away. And what they were really doing was saying, in fact, you know what, there were Arabs when we arrived. And in fact, Israel as a state and the Jews who came treated them pretty badly. In fact, there was ethnic cleansing in 1948. And that generally is now an accepted, when I say it's accepted, a lot of people don't accept this, but the reason why that narrative has now been challenged quite successfully is that one only has to look last year, for example, at Israel's 60th birth. Now, when the New York Times covered this issue last May, in decades past, when it was the 50th anniversary or 40th anniversary, the issue of Palestinian rights or independence or issues was virtually ignored. Last year, despite the fact that the New York Times is very, very pro-Israel, but nonetheless, there was space and articles given to a narrative that was talking about the Nakba, and the Nakba is a term for the destruction. In other words, the catastrophe. Arabs regard 1948 as a catastrophe, and Jews regard it as their, you know, beginning of their new life. As a
1948
homeland.
Was when Israel was established.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating about that is that the narrative, although still very pro-Israel in much of the American, I would say, political and media elite, there are shifts going on. Mm. And I guess we'll talk about the Gaza war later on. But last year was, in fact, an interesting turning point about that. And those sort of articles that are in the New York Times, while not exactly signifying a change of everything, is significant because that wouldn't have existed before. So when I was at university, I started reading these kind of articles, these kind of books, mainly from Israelis, Jews. Mm. And what was fascinating about it was that it was utterly opposed to what I'd been told for the first 20 years of my life.
That must have been really strange for you.
Well, it was strange because when I tried to raise it at, say, family events, which I would now and then, I was shouted down.
You must not have understood why.
I don't think I did. I think I got savvier as time went on, I guess as we all do, but there was a sense that there was no discussion needed. There was no interest or need for a discussion, but of course I also felt then that there was profound ignorance about what was going on. In other words, a lot of Jews, and I'm generalising here, but many Jews, like a lot of ethnic groups, like to romanticise their own people's or country's history and past. It's far easier to imagine the myth about Israel being this wonderful, plucky state that came out of nowhere, as opposed to looking at the facts and the documents which clearly show from 1947 and 8 onwards that there was profound ethnic cleansing going on against the Palestinians, who weren't known as Palestinians then, but against the Arabs who were there. And those kind of myths, I would argue, still are pretty powerful. And of course, at university, learning about that kind of thing, or reading about it myself, really, opened a Pandora's box.
Now, Anthony, I'm interviewing Anthony Lowenstein, who is obviously Australian, who wrote a best-selling book, My Israel Question, published by Melbourne University Publishing in 2006. Anthony, then the obvious question to ask you is, did you then go to Israel?
Well, I did go eventually, but I didn't go in my I didn't go that soon. I wanted to go a number of different times, and for different reasons it didn't work out. But I did go to Israel eventually, and Palestine for that matter.
When did you go?
In 2005.
Okay, so tell us your impressions when you actually went there.
I actually found Israel itself both fascinating and repulsive. And fascinating because when one goes to a place like Jerusalem, you can't but be overwhelmed by the history. It's an incredibly atmospheric place. It's beautiful. It's an amazing place. I didn't feel, though, going there, as many Jews say they do, particularly Jewish. In other words, I didn't go to the Wailing Wall, which is the sort of central space in modern Jewish sort of history, I suppose, and feel, wow, I'm really feeling Jewish now. You know, some people might go to, I don't know, the Vatican, say, and feel very Catholic or whatever. I didn't feel particularly Jewish being there. And I guess the reason for that was, although it's a very moving space and you have Jews who are praying there who are completely into their religion, I found it impossible to separate what I was seeing in, say, Jerusalem, which was beautiful, to literally 10 kilometres, if not less, down the road, pretty much hidden away, which is East Jerusalem, or for that matter, the occupation in the West Bank. So Israel has very cleverly, in some ways, hidden from a great deal of Jewish Israelis' view what they're doing to the Arabs. Now, you can drive 10 kilometres down the road from Jerusalem as an Israeli Jew and see this, but virtually nobody does. And if you go to East Jerusalem, which is a predominantly Arab area, and then you can cross into the West Bank, there's a massive wall, which many of your listeners probably would have seen on TV. Israel calls it the security wall, security barrier. Palestinians call it the apartheid wall. Essentially, it was Israel built this wall, they said, to stop terrorists entering Israel to blow themselves up. And although security could well be one of the reasons, the reality was it was also to change the potential borders of a future Israeli state. The wall itself does not go along internationally recognized borders. It directly goes within and inside Palestinian land, deliberately so, deliberately so. So being in Jerusalem or being Israel itself, although Tel Aviv, again, is an amazingly vibrant city, very young, you can feel in those cities, Helen, completely disconnected from what goes on down the road. Literally.
Yeah.
I've never been to a place where people might sort of say, oh, you know, this is happening hundreds of kilometres down the road, 10 Ks down the road. And there is an ability. When I was there, there was virtually no violence within Israel itself. Mm. There was a suicide bombing, I think, in Tel Aviv. But generally, those attacks had stopped then. I could not separate knowing what Israel and Jews were doing, frankly, in my name, down the road in the West Bank. So I liked Israel. I met a lot of fantastic people there.
Yeah.
But in some ways, I felt I found the West Bank more interesting, and I spent quite a lot of time in the West Bank as well.
It reminds me a little bit, as you speak, of Washington, D.C., which is the most glorious city with huge, gorgeous marble monuments and the like. And then just, you know, a few kilometres down the road again, or miles, there's a very repressed or poor African-American community, and the majority of people living in D.C. are actually African-Americans.
Well, yeah, I remember reading about that a few weeks ago when Obama's inauguration, where they sort of had a couple of news channels did stories about that, you know, asking those sort of guys, African-Americans, so what do you think, you know, that all these guys are coming to Washington to celebrate the wonderful, you know, Messiah, new Messiah, so to speak. What do you think about it? Most of them, some of them were pretty rapt, and some of them sort of, you couldn't help but think they were saying to themselves, this is so removed from my reality.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what Obama actually does for his people, and I think that he will move to help them. I have quite a clear sense about that. But let's then, Anthony Lowenstein, get back to Israel, which is a very pertinent topic now. Mm. How many Palestinians-Arabs were there when the Israeli state was first established in 1948? What was their population?
The exact numbers, like to the number, is impossible to say, but the argument that many of the new historians in the 80s put was that roughly 750,000 Arabs were pushed out or were removed forcibly from Israel, or the state of Israel, when it was born. There were other Arabs, some who remained, there were others, but roughly 750,000 to 850,000.
So they lost their homes, their properties, their
land. Yeah, some properties had undoubtedly been legally sold, so to speak, to Jews.
Yeah.
I'm not saying every single land was stolen, that's not true.
Right.
But a lot of what happened was, and this is far too complex to go into in detail, but essentially what happened was that there were two issues. Firstly, there was a great deal of terror that was used by the incoming Jewish forces to essentially scare people away, and it was done forcibly. Secondly, a lot of people said, and in fact often when you go to Palestine you see people and older people who have the keys to their house, like actually the keys. Now, this is now done more of a symbolic way. For example, someone of my age or someone who's 20, of course, wasn't around in 1948. And the question really always has been, when or if there's ever a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, what does one actually do with the refugee question? Now, the refugee question is a completely complicated one, because Israel says, if we allow every single Palestinian refugee to come back into Israel, if we sign a peace deal tomorrow, that we will be swamped by Arabs and the Jewish state will not exist because there'll be far more Arabs than Jews. Now, my view about that has been that as a Jew right now, I can go to Israel today, and if I can prove that I'm Jewish, I can get Jewish or Israeli citizenship pretty quickly. If I'm a Palestinian and I have equal ability to prove that my family was born in Nablus or wherever it may be, the reality would be I cannot get citizenship. So the so-called right of return, which is one of the key tenets of Zionism, for me, is utterly racist, and more importantly, is actually incredibly unequal, because if a Palestinian can't do it, then why the hell should I be able to do it? So
what's the population of Israel now?
It's about 6 to 6 million, roughly.
6 million
Jews,
and
6 million Jews.
Oh yeah, and then we're talking about Gaza and the West Bank, and where else would the Palestinians come back if, in fact, that ever happened? And how many are there?
There's about 5 to 6 million Israeli Jews. There are roughly about 1.2 million Israeli Arabs within Israel itself. So
yes,
it's roughly 20% of the population are Israeli Arabs.
No, but right of return.
Indeed.
How many would come back if such a thing?
That's a very good question. The actual number is impossible to say. There are millions. Now, of course, after 1948, and indeed after 1967 even more so, there is a massive Palestinian diaspora. There are some in Jordan, there are some in Lebanon, there are some all over the place. Obviously, there are some in Australia. The question really is, and many in America for that matter, the question really is, of course, if there was an ability for Palestinians to return to their old homeland tomorrow, would they all go? Now, I would argue probably not. It's impossible to say, but that obviously has to be negotiated in the peace deal, how that would work in a practical sense. Israel has always said, and maintains this line, that if there's an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, which I would argue there probably will not be for a very long time, Palestinians have the right to return, but not to the Israeli state, to the Palestinian state. In other words, even if someone's ancestors or home is in the Israeli state, they aren't allowed to return. And which I have a major problem with, frankly. It's inappropriate and simply does not address the fundamental rights of right of return. I mean, if you can't return, or if you even want to return to the area upon which you came, or your family came, there's no chance of justice. And the question really is that the millions upon millions of Palestinians who now live in the West Bank and Gaza, within 5 or 10 years, demographers say that there'll be more Arabs in Israel itself and the West Bank and Gaza than Jews in Israel. In other words, within 5 or 10 years, Arabs will outnumber Jews. Now, unless there's some massive peace deal in the next years, some kind of agreement, some kind of two-state solution, some kind of amazing deal that's struck by Obama or whatever, Israel has a real problem on its hands, because the reality is that a minority population ruling over a majority is apartheid by definition. I would argue what Israel does in occupied territories is apartheid now. But this is what happened in South Africa, where a minority fear, of course, the majority rule. But the reality is that you would like to think, and I would like to think, that would the world, the so-called civilized world, accept a situation where Arabs are being ruled over by a minority Jewish population? Now, I don't know the answer to that, but many of the people who are in Israel who are quite strongly Zionist but are aware of this demographic reality wonder how this is actually going to work. Because if it's been fighting, in other words, the birth rates are far higher, obviously, in the Arab population than the Jewish population, but how does that work in a practical sense? And I'm not really sure the answer to that, except to say that the so-called two-state solution, which President Obama and George Mitchell, the new Middle East envoy, and Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, everyone's talking about these wonderful ideas of a two-state solution. But what a lot of people don't seem to want to address, and there was a fantastic, listeners can look, 60 Minutes, the American 60 Minutes, to this amazing program last Sunday, which you can find online very easily, about this very issue. And although this is something that many people who follow this issue would know very well, to have it on a mainstream American news channel was quite revelatory.
Well, what did 60 Minutes show, Anthony?
The show basically said that Bob Simons, who's a journalist, went to the West Bank and Israel itself and said that with the hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers who are now living illegally on Palestinian land, has essentially made...
In the West Bank.
In the West Bank. Has essentially made the possibility of a two-state solution pretty much dead. In other words, if there is going to be a two-state solution, the question is where and how?
Well, I have to profess some ignorance here. Anthony, how do you define the two-state solution, and when did that theory originate? When?
Yeah, the two-state solution has been talked about for many, many years, not least after 1967, which is the Six-Day War when Israel claimed the West Bank and Gaza. Now, the problem with that has been for Israel that essentially by taking over the West Bank and Gaza, they also took over the Palestinian populations who were there, who by definition are going to be pretty pissed off to actually being ruled over by Israel or by the Israelis. So a two-state solution was drafted a number of years ago as an idea where you have an Israeli Jewish state for Jews and a Palestinian state of Palestinians, whether they're Muslim or whatever they may be, or Christian. There's been negotiations about this for years.
Well, so since before 1967?
This is definitely post-67.
Ah.
Really, the two-state solution has really been seriously talked about only in the last 20 years. I mean, it's been talked about for longer than that, but in a serious way. And in the 1990s, when President Bill Clinton was in power, some of your listeners would remember there was a very famous signing on the White House lawn between Bill Clinton, Yasser Arafat, and Yitzhak Rabin, who was then the Israeli Prime Minister, was assassinated 2 years later by a Jewish fundamentalist in Israel. And that message essentially was, we are moving towards two-state solutions. So the settlements in the West Bank, which international law and the UN, every single international body regards as illegal, will be removed.
Yeah.
The settlers will be removed. And a Palestinian state at some point will be established in that area, in the West Bank and Gaza. And that never happened for a multitude of reasons, not least because, and this is what people often forget, during the 90s, when everyone was talking about peace and there was the Oslo Peace Accords and everyone was feeling pretty good about things, the settlements, in fact, doubled in size.
Well, why? Why?
Well, this is a why. Well, the settlements kind of are the true Achilles heel of this conflict. And the reality is that since 67, Israeli politicians from across the board, from the so-called left to the so-called right, have all given a wink to the settlements. In other words, Zionism has always been about, in my view and many other people's view, about expanding the land, putting facts on the ground, making certain facts irreversible.
But why would they do that knowing that it would mitigate against the two-state solution and that eventually the Arabs would outbreed the Jews and it would lead to the most massive problem? I can't understand their thinking.
Well, I guess it's very hard to answer that, except to say, A, imagining in 67 the idea where things would be now would obviously be very difficult for people to imagine.
Right.
Secondly, the idea that Israel would get enough international support and international countries turning a blind eye to what Israel does, which frankly hasn't really changed. I mean, let's face it, when the settlements have now reached as big as they are, and you have in the West Bank hundreds of thousands of people. There are roughly roughly a quarter of a million Jews in the West Bank, settlers who are there illegally under international law. There are roughly a quarter of a million settlers living illegally around East Jerusalem as settlers. You have roughly 500,000 Jewish settlers on Palestinian land, building settlements with the support of the Israeli state. Now, when you hear leader after leader from Israel saying, yes, the settlements are bad, we must end them.
Yeah.
That is what is said to the international community. What the reality is, the governments are supporting them and they have for decades. That's the reality. And they're doing it because they think, and they've always thought, and the international community has not proven otherwise, who's going to stop them? Who stops them? Nobody stops them. I mean, this is the bottom line. When you have 500,000 people on Palestinian land, what Israel really is saying is, we can't reverse this anymore. This is a reality. Accept it. Now, what, of course, that means is, yes, it's not a Palestinian state. But the reality is that I would argue Israel and much of the American political elite, there's no desire for a two-state solution. It's rhetoric for the sake of rhetoric. In other words, when you hear in the media this is the peace process, there is no peace process.
I'm interviewing Anthony Lowenstein, who is Australian and has written a book called My Israel Question, published by Melbourne University Publishing, a best-selling book, which I would advise you all to obtain, probably through Amazon.
Yep.
The thing for me is, I suppose, being a physician and always having to prognosticate about the state of a person's health into the future and how they will progress with their particular disease or whatever. It's clear, as you describe it, Anthony, that this process of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories and the proliferation in terms of birth numbers of the Arabic or Palestinian population, that within a decade or so, as you pointed out, that the Palestinians will outnumber the Jews by a substantial ratio. And as you said, you can't imagine what the solution would be. It's just going to get worse, isn't it? The violence, the attacks, the recrimination, the anger.
Many of us fear this. I mean, of course, the recent war in Gaza, the 22-day war, launched on December 27th from Israel against Gaza and Hamas, has only made this 1,000 times worse. I mean, the simple reality is that Israel clearly chose its timing very well. The Bush administration was on the way out. The Obama administration was on the way in.
Mm.
They have had in the last 8 years, Israel that is, pretty much carte blanche to do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is defined in the mainstream as Bush being so-called pro-Israel. In fact, it's actually being very anti-Israel. Anyone who understands this conflict realizes that the best friends are always people who both offer praise and criticism, and that's the reality. And sadly, Israel is the only country in the world, and we saw this during last year's American election between McCain and Obama, where it's the only country that consistently and regularly they are forced to come out and say publicly over and over again, we love Israel. There was an amazing debate between Sarah Palin, who was the Republican vice presidential nominee, and Joe Biden, who's the Democrat guy, of course, who won in the end. And in that debate, they only had one presidential TV debate. They consistently both came out, I love Israel. No, I love Israel more. No, I love Israel more. It's as if what other country requires this kind of loyalty test? I mean, again, during the recent war with Gaza, there was a vote in Congress in the House, and pretty much with a handful of dissenters, bless them, unanimous support. In other words, Israel is perfectly right to do whatever it wants. There is no other country on the planet where this occurs. And the question why that happens, many different reasons. There's obviously a very powerful Israel lobby in America. There is a question of a lot of support from the Democrat Party, at least, often is very financial. There is a sense and a fear, which I think is shifting slowly but surely. Criticizing Israel publicly can affect your career. There's no doubt about that. It can also help your career too, depending who you are. But it's a very sensitive issue. And a lot of people have realized over the years, in America but elsewhere too, that being critical of Israel, you are labelled, can be labelled as anti-Semitic or self-hating Jew or whatever it may be, and it's toxic and people don't want to do it. Now, that is shifting to the extent that the Bush years, ironically, have actually made that easier. And I think for a lot of people...
How so?
Well, one of the few advantages of the Bush years, and there aren't many of them, but there are a few pluses, believe it or not, has been an opening up of this debate. And... The reason I think for that is that a blind man can see that Bush administration policies in the Middle East, others towards Iraq, Iran, Israel, Palestine, have actually been disastrous. Mm. And the security, if one truly believes in the security of Israel, if that's what people who support Israel do, Israel is far less safe now than it was 8 years ago. It's more isolated now than it was 8 years ago.
Because of
its incredibly reckless behaviour, either in Lebanon in 2006 or its behaviour in Gaza in the last 3 weeks, or the fact that the settlements are expanding and expanding. People, I think, in the West and America as well, don't actually realise often how most of the world views this issue. There is generally international consensus by a mile that says what Israel does is utterly outrageous. And if one looks at the American media and much of the Western media, everyone says, you know, this is part of a debate. There is virtually no debate going on. The reality is, if you look at the UN, for years and years and years, every country bar five or six supports very simple things. A two-state solution, the end of settlements in the West Bank, reparations for refugees, the splitting of Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera. if you look at the American media, this is sort of posed as, well, it's a very complex issue. It's not that complex. But the US veto in the UN has made any progress on this virtually impossible. Now, the problem with this has been that years and years and years of American indulgence and financial support. And, of course, remember that Israel is the highest recipient of U.S. aid in the world every year.
$3 billion a year.
$3 billion
Most of it spent on weapons.
Indeed. Well, $3 billion plus.
But Egypt gets the same amount.
Egypt gets about $2 to $3 billion. Yeah. Egypt is second and Jordan is third. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
And so, and of course, ironically and rather interestingly enough, Jordan, I would argue, and Egypt receive that money in some ways since their peace deals with Israel. I would argue to try and placate them and just keep them happy that they're at peace with Israel. If you ask most people in both those countries, study after study has shown this, in Jordan and Egypt, they do not want to be at peace with Israel. Their governments might want to be so-called at peace.
Because of the money they're receiving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so Israel essentially is a client state of the US. Now, I'm not saying if it does everything America wants, it's more complicated than
that. No, but why would Israel be a client state of the US? What does Israel have to offer the US? Obviously, the US has much to offer Israel, but in pragmatic terms...
Well, Israel, I suppose, can offer, as is happening more and more now, a great deal of base for US infrastructure and US weapons.
Oh, really?
Israel has become one of the top five arms manufacturers in the world. Israel, for example, tests a great deal of weapons, including in the last 3 weeks in Gaza.
What, I mean, US weapons?
US weapons. I mean, Israel is one. Yeah, I mean, America basically provides the vast majority of weapons for Israel and many other countries too. I mean, America is the greatest weapons manufacturer in the world by a mile.
Yeah.
Israel's in the top five. It's getting higher and higher every year.
Yeah.
And one of the relationships between the US and Israel, which is really discussed, is about the weapons industry. This is a billions and billions of dollar industry. So that relationship is very profitable for a number of different people. Hence, that's continuing. That's not going to change under Obama.
So you think one of the main things that Israel can offer America, and this is obviously under the table subliminal, is the weapons industry and the
military. Part of it, undoubtedly. I mean, that's one reason. That's not the only
one.
What
else?
One of them. I think the issue of having the countries that are in the Middle East that America is friendly with, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, they're friendly, but I think America has always been a bit suspicious that they could turn tomorrow. They probably won't, but they could.
And America would lose its oil supply.
Well, yes, I mean, for no other reason than that, America and Saudi Arabia are going to be sort of, you know, friends till death. I mean, the oil pretty much speaks for itself. But Israel in that way is regarded, Israel is seen, and in fact many people who you speak to about this issue will say, Israel's just like us.
Mm.
And in fact many people after 9/11 in Australia and in America as well said, we're all Israelis now, which is such a nonsense term. In other words, Israel, the theory being that Israel has been dealing with Islamic fundamentalism for years.
Oh.
And so the theory now is, and this of course not ever theory, I mean it's explicitly stated, that the relationship between America and Israel after 9/11 deepened, undoubtedly so under the Bush administration, deep before. So the idea that, after 9/11, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's a former Prime Minister of Israel, who's running in the forthcoming elections and will probably win again, God help us, on February the 10th, has made a number of statements and has said quite explicitly and pretty shamefully, 9/11 has been wonderful for Israel. It's been wonderful for business. And what he means by that is that much of the West and the whole war on terror rhetoric that the Bush administration has put forward, which Obama may change, we'll have to wait and see about that, is actually very much about saying Israel is the only so-called democracy in the Middle East. It's an oasis amongst kind of a countries full of barbarians, and therefore that's why we support Israel. And much of the war on terror rhetoric in the U.S. in the last 8 years, has very much tied into that kind of mindset. So for Israel's sake, the wars in Iraq and elsewhere, and war on terror, so to speak, has actually been incredibly profitable, both financially and also politically and diplomatically.
I'm interviewing Anthony Lowenstein from Australia, who wrote a best-selling book, My Israel Question, published by Melbourne University Publishing in 2006. I want to move on then to the nuclear part of this, which is almost never discussed. It did come up during the Gazan conflict recently when it was stated that Israel was worried that the weapons that Hamas now has could actually get to Dimona, which is where Israel makes its plutonium, has a nuclear reactor, and Israel is said by some to be the third largest nuclear power in the world with 200 to 400 hydrogen bombs. I, just having spent my life questioning the nuclear issue and trying to educate people about it from a medical perspective, it seems suicidal to me for Israel to have an arsenal of nuclear weapons when it's surrounded by enemies, all of whom obviously could react similarly and want their own nuclear weapons. What's your take on that, Anthony?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, and the reality is that, in fact, that is what's happening. There's been evidence in the last few years, a number of Arab states, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Jordan, have talked openly about building their own nuclear facilities. They say it's not...
nuclear reactors.
They're talking about reactors rather than nuclear weapons, and who knows if it doesn't mean both. It wouldn't surprise me if it did.
Well, it actually does, because once you've got a reactor, you've got bomb-grade material.
There you go. And the argument, of course, that's given for this is not so much about Israel, though. It's because they, this is what they say publicly anyway, they fear Iran. And one of the key issues about Israel and its nuclear...
But they haven't always said that. They built their nuclear weapons when they started way back under Golda, in the 50s?
Indeed. Well, I mean...
And Iran wasn't a problem
then.
No,
I agree. Well, the issue with Israel and its nuclear capability is a fascinating story, which is too complicated to go into here. But no one knows exactly. It's just that Israel doesn't even acknowledge it has nuclear weapons.
Yeah, but everyone knows it does, so that's silly. Yeah.
It does. This so-called ambiguity, I'm not quite sure why they sort of put that idea up anymore. It's a bit nonsense. But I think one of the key weirdness about this issue in the Middle East is that whenever America or Israel talks about eradicating weapons from the region, no one sort of mentions the obvious
Israel
in the room with nuclear weapons itself. But of course, when this argument is put forward, people say yes, but Israel has no choice but to have them. You know, it's purely defensive, not offensive, okay? Because if they haven't got them, they could be obliterated tomorrow, right?
So who's going to stop them being obliterated, even if they have nuclear weapons?
Well, you tell me. Now, the problem with this argument, of course, apart from the obvious, it's just illogical, is that it's hypocritical, and more importantly, it has allowed a situation in the last 8 years, again, during the Bush administration, has been disastrous for this issue. One of the great beneficiaries, of course, of the Iraq war has been Iran, and people who are opposed to the war, including myself and many others, said that if you want to give Iran the biggest leg up imaginable, you go into Iraq, and this is exactly what's happened.
But why has that given Iran support? I don't understand that. Why, by bombing the hell out of Iraq and virtually destroying it as a civilized nation at this point in time, how has that given support to Iran? I don't understand that.
A few different reasons. Firstly, despite the fact that Iran and Iraq had a pretty ferocious war in the 80s.
Yes, sponsored by the United States.
Indeed, which achieved absolutely nothing apart from millions upon millions of deaths. Iran and Iraq have a long history, which goes back, which generally is friend and foe. So they're actually quite close. Many of the people who were in exile outside Iraq, who had left because of Saddam's butchery, were affiliated or close to Iran. Many of the leaders of Iraq today, I've had spent many years in Iran or been associated close to Iran. That's the first thing. Secondly, the Shia, who are of course the majority population of Iraq, are associated, well, because Iran is a Shia nation. That's the second point. And there's a great deal of association between the religious affiliations of Iran and Shia Muslims in Iraq. That's the second thing. Third thing is that when the violence in Iraq was out of control, it's still now bad, but it's come down a bit in the last year or so. The Iran was undoubtedly backing some of the sides in this war. There's no doubt about that, as they were expected to do. Iran sees Iraq as a potential ally and friend, and the reality is that what the Iraq war did for Iran is something that America never really fully understood. This idea that America actually still has a great deal of control over Iraq is woefully misplaced. Yes, America has hundreds of thousands of troops there. They have a great deal of influence. But the reality is, in the last years...
And they have a puppet government.
They have a puppet government, which much of whom is affiliated with Iran. I mean, one doesn't read much about in the Western press. But often the Iraqi leaders, they're going to Iran all the time and vice versa. And I'm not saying it's an Iranian client state. What I'm saying is, though, They're very close to each other.
That's right.
So to some extent, Iran does not want Iraq to collapse, because that's, of course, going to be a disaster on its doorstep.
Mm.
Some would argue it actually does not want American troops to leave either, because while American troops are pinned down in Iraq, the theory being they're less likely to do something against Iran, maybe. So the theory goes. The issue of the nuclear question, though, is tied into this, because, of course, Iran, no one actually knows exactly what Iran is doing, but according to the latest...
Well, we do know they're enriching uranium.
We know they're enriching uranium, indeed. And
we know they've got over 3,000 centrifuges now.
Indeed. In terms of what that's actually for, and look, no one actually knows. The latest report that came out a while ago from the...
IAEA.
Exactly. Pretty much said, we have no evidence of nuclear weapons, but there are a lot of unanswered questions, basically.
Yeah.
And frankly, if I was Iran, I'd want to get nuclear weapons as well. It makes perfect sense. And one would argue, in fact, that North Korea, as crazy as that leadership is, the only reason, I would argue, one of the key reasons why America didn't invade North Korea or attack it militarily, is because it had nukes. In the theory, I'm not saying that justifies again, though. I'm saying from their logic, having nuclear weapons gives a country reason to feel protected against the US. In other words, if the US, which it did after 9/11 towards Iran and North Korea, said, basically, you are part of the axis of evil, what would a country do in that logic to try and protect itself? Now, I'm not justifying nuclear weapons. What I'm saying is, in that logic, it makes perfect sense, in my view, and many others' view, to get nuclear weapons to protect yourself from potential
attacks.
It's all crazy.
It's why I called my book in the 1980s Anthony Missile Envy. It really is this sort of masculine logic which leads nowhere except to, maybe annihilation.
Exactly. And I think with Iran, the hope, of course, is now that there is some kind of detente of sorts or some kind of negotiation between the US and Iran, or for that matter, between Israel and Iran. Well, keep in mind the fact that so much of the rhetoric coming out of the US and Israel towards Iran is sort of hypocritical, because only very few years ago, Israel and Iran were good mates. So the problem has been, I think, for Israel that Iran now, of course, has become a regional power far more than it was 5-6 years ago. Iran is still a relatively weak state compared to Israel.
They've got a large military, though.
There's a large military. So did Saddam, though, for that matter. Of course, one of the reasons why America went into Iraq, not Iran, was they figured Iraq was going to be a pushover.
Yeah.
Militarily, initially, it was. I mean, Saddam fell in 3 weeks. There was never going to be a question that Saddam's army was weakened. A lot of his people didn't like him. The war, in some ways, in inverted commas, was over in 3 weeks. What, of course, happened after that is documented, very well. But, and Iran, of course, was regarded as a great, much greater threat, and therefore it was a lot more difficult to consider invading Iran. Of course, the issue also is that people don't know much about is that in 2003, the Iranians put forward a proposal through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran to offer this to the Americans, to sort of say, we are willing to discuss with you a grand bargain. Now, this grand bargain was going to involve serious discussion about Iran's support from Hamas and Hezbollah, both groups that the US and Israel don't like, a serious discussion about its nuclear program, and an improving of ties between Iran, Israel, and the US. America knocked this back without even discussing it.
Well, President Bush didn't even read the letter.
Indeed. And now, whether Iran was serious, who knows? But you know what? At least you give it a go, right? And the hope is that with Obama, this changes. I hope it does. At the moment, it's too early to tell. I mean, yes, there's been some positive signs. I mean, the problem is the person he's appointed to manage this problem is Dennis Ross. And Dennis Ross, for listeners who don't know, in the 90s was one of the key lieutenants in the Clinton administration trying to deal with the Israel-Palestine conflict, and it failed miserably. And he's not a particularly honest broker, in my view. But nonetheless,
I wonder why he appointed. I can understand George Mitchell being appointed, who's, I think, quite a noble man.
Seems to be.
And he helped bring about the Northern Ireland Peace Accords. But I don't understand why he appointed Dennis Ross.
Well, good question. I think probably Ross has always been very close to Clinton. I think Ross is also seen as someone. I think my understanding is that Obama did not want to appoint someone who would cause him political grief. And someone like Dennis Ross, probably in the Washington political elite, is regarded as fairly reliable, which means in the Middle East pretty useless. I think one of the problems, I think, one of the good things why Mitchell was appointed, well, I guess we'll wait and see how effective he is that he is regarded by both sides fairly evenly. Mm. Had they appointed someone like Dennis Ross, who was, frankly, on the table, that would have been a disaster because essentially he's regarded as far too pro-Israel, as useless. Yeah. Now, how he's regarded vis-a-vis Iran, I guess they hope is that they think Obama thinks Dennis Ross is a head kicker, which he may well be. I don't know. I'm not that optimistic about that side of it. Having said that, I think Iran, in many ways, actually, Iran wants a better relationship with the West.
Yes,
Iran's
it does.
Economy is struggling. Yep. It's not going that well. And there's an election in Iran.
As is the U.S. economy.
As the U.S. all our economies.
Yeah,
Iran
yeah.
has election fairly soon.
Yeah.
And no one, of course, knows the result of that. But Ahmadinejad will run again, and there's a good chance he might win again. We don't really know. There are people who are running across against him. The Iranian political system is complex, to say the least. Mm. I talked a bit about it in my last book, The Blogging Revolution. But although there are elections, you have to be approved as a candidate before you're allowed to run, and many more liberal candidates are excluded because they're too liberal. So it's a weird system, to say the least, but people can vote, and let's hope that there's some kind of... I hope there's a change of government there, but if there's not, Ahmadinejad's rhetoric may well come down simply because of economic reality.
Now, we've only got 5 minutes left, Anthony. I want you just to prognosticate about the Israeli election upcoming early in February, but knowing that this program will be aired after that time, just can you make some hypothetical prognostications about the Israeli election?
Well, the election is on February the 10th, as you said. There are three main candidates. Ehud Barak, who's the current defence minister, Tzipi Livni, who's the current foreign minister, and Benjamin Netanyahu, who is not in government now, he's in the Likud, was prime minister in the 90s and is running again.
Yeah.
The polls all say that he's going to win.
Yep.
The war in Gaza apparently has strengthened him even more than it was before. The supreme tragic irony is that Livni and Barak, both of whom were key lieutenants in the recent war, may well lose. In other words, the supposed benefit, arguably, of going to this war was the hope that they would benefit electorally.
Well, one of the reasons it has been said that Israel went into Gaza is because of the upcoming election.
Undoubtedly so.
And I feel bad because we really haven't talked about Gaza at all, which is why I wanted to interview you.
No, that's okay. Well,
and the dreadful, dreadful carnage there. That's another whole issue philosophically and the like, you know, that we should have discussed. And I, as a physician, can hardly bear to read reports about what happened there.
The situation there is agreement. I guess all I'd say about that is that inevitably and eventually, whether America or Israel accepts it or understands it, Hamas has to be engaged, as simple as that. Mm. Hamas is a reality. It has a massive political support and force. Doesn't mean one endorses its views, but it's a reality.
But the other thing is we didn't talk about the fact that Israel helped to initiate Hamas in the first place.
Indeed.
Is one of the founders of Hamas and supported it financially for years and years and years.
Mm.
Another sort of policy that's turned upside down to be antithetical to what Israel needs and requires for the future peace of Israel and living harmoniously. So,
it's very sort of comparable in some ways, the Americans funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 80s.
That's right,
and then
the Taliban.
And it becomes Al-Qaeda, yeah. So Netanyahu probably will win, as we know.
Mm.
He's obviously part of the right-wing party. He's associated with even further right groups, including Avigdor Lieberman, who's a Russian immigrant, who's has a lot of support in Israel, mainly from Russian immigrants. There's about a million of those, so they're pretty popular.
Mm.
And their views are unabashedly racist. They talk about forcibly transferring Arabs. They talk about the idea of forcing Israeli Arabs to declare their kind of loyalty to the Jewish state. It's an openly racist party.
Mm.
And the concern is that even if Obama wants to change the rules of the game over there, how does that work potentially with the Netanyahu administration? I'm not sure the answer to that.
No.
Except to say that Netanyahu on the weekend, a few days ago, we're talking about late January now, was saying that, yes, he opposes new settlements except natural growth. This is a line, natural growth.
Mm.
And natural growth essentially means that settlements that exist can keep on expanding and expanding and expanding. George Mitchell, the Middle East envoy, put out a report in 2001 which said clearly that settlements, including natural growth, has to end.
Mm.
Now, what's going to happen, I think, in time is that Israel and America, to some extent, are on a collision course. It's inevitable. If Obama, which no US president has really ever done, actually puts equal pressure on Israel to say, settlement expansion must stop, no ifs, no buts, full stop, then the reality is that the vast majority of a lot of the political elite in Israel who support the settlements have to essentially either change their ways or decide to tell America to bugger off. Now, as I said, this has never happened before. Really, it's happened occasionally, briefly here and there, but never in a serious way. So on one level, the prospect of America telling Israel what to do and Israel doing it's kind of a nice thought because it's never happened before. But at the same time, there is profound pressure in the American political elite from the Israel lobby towards the American administration to sort of say, don't put pressure on Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, appointing George Mitchell has actually interestingly caused a great deal of angst in the Zionist lobby in the States, which is a good thing. They're worried that, and the quote was, he's too even-handed. That's actually a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying is that the coming while is obviously very unclear, but I fear a few things, just briefly, is that I think another round between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon is not unlikely. Mm. In fact, I think it's quite likely. Mm. The issue of Hamas in Gaza is utterly, utterly unresolved. Mm. And as to what's going to happen there and how that's going to work, of course, I don't know. But as I said, inevitably and eventually, Israel, like accepting the PLO years ago, will have to accept Hamas. And I should say just finally that since Hamas won the election in 2006, undoubtedly in the past they've committed terrorist acts, there's no question about that, but they've become far more pragmatic. They've spoken openly about a two-state solution regularly. I talked about accepting Israel in 1967 borders. They've accepted all these things, and yet this is ignored by much of the Western media and the political elite. In other words, they're saying what the West wants them to say. And as someone said to me recently, the reason they're a danger is because they say they want to talk. That's actually the danger.
It's very interesting psychologically, isn't it, Anthony? And I would just end by saying that from my perspective, a global nuclear holocaust could be initiated either in the Middle East, which is just a boiling cauldron at the moment, armed with nuclear weapons from Israel, or on the Indian subcontinent between Pakistan and India, and that then could have invoke the nuclear weapons on head trigger alert between Russia and America. So it's an extraordinarily important issue, which I think must be discussed openly and candidly and honestly, as you have today, Anthony. So I thank you very much for appearing on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My very special guest today on If You Love This Planet has been Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney-based independent freelance journalist, author and blogger. His best-selling book on the Israel-Palestinian conflict, My Israel Question, released by Melbourne University Publishing in 2006, can be obtained from Amazon.com. Thank you very much for listening again to this very fascinating interview, I think, which opened up a lot of topics that need open, honest discussion and debate. I thank my producer in Australia, Jasmine Williams, my producer in America, Scott Powell, and my outreach coordinator, Amanda Bellaby. Talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.